Good evening. Welcome to Lehigh Valley Art Salon. I'm your host, Bathsheba Monk, and I'm thrilled to welcome to the studio an author whose work I very much admire, Lee Upton, and we're going to talk about her stunning new book of short stories, The Tao of Humiliation. Lee is the author of 12 other books, including essays, criticism, fiction, and most notably poetry, as well as teaching English at Lafayette College and being the artist in residence there. Welcome to the Art Salon, Lee.
Oh, thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
First of all, I have to mention that The Tao of Humiliation is getting rave reviews. Kirkus gave it a starred review, which it gives only to books of exceptional merit. Publishers Weekly and Booklist called it smart and entertaining. And for what it's worth, when I first got the book, I picked it up and opened it to one story at random, Will Anyone Ever Know Me?, which is seven and a half pages long, excuse me. And at the end of the book, I closed it and said, wow, what just happened here? This is some very fine writing. So tell us the story about that and how you came to write it. Will anyone ever know me?
That's a harrowing story in many ways because of the sense of a child being enslaved, a child in sex slavery, and coming to write that. In some ways, the story seemed to write itself in many ways, that sense of helplessness that the people feel when they encounter the child is so prominent, I think.
Well, how did they even get her? They just stole her, right?
Yeah, she appears in their hotel room and...
As a sex worker.
Yes, she's a little child, and they figure out the situation, and they do what they can to get her out of the country, and then at the same time, they've lost their own daughter, and what's somewhat terrifying about the story is that the woman, in some ways, becomes afraid of the child at first.
And why is she afraid of her?
Because she does not want to imagine what the child has been through. And at the same time, she's lost her own daughter, has died, and she fears that this new child will replace her memory of her own child. So she upbraids herself for these feelings, but the feelings are very real to her at the same time.
And so the whole idea that you can even replace a daughter with another child is, I mean, that's the question that was very interesting to me. Is that even possible?
As,
you know,
I don't think it's possible. They have to encounter a new kind of reality.
Right. This is one of the things that is so powerful about this collection is they're not just, all the reviews say, oh, there's stories, you know, Upton writes about relationships. It's like, wow, well, this is a different relationship than the kind you usually encounter in fiction now. This is very powerful. Where did you get the idea for this?
I think just reading reports about children and what children have suffered, thinking about that, my love of my own daughters, so that sense of identifying what it would be for this child to experience this. So in some ways, that story was one that really, it's a story of struggle, but at the same time, it wasn't a struggle to write.
Right, because you could identify sort of with her. Did you mention the country that this was in?
No.
Okay. No. I kept looking through, where is this now?
Yeah, okay. But it could happen in many places, including in this country in a sense, too, although they wouldn't have to worry about customs, but taking a child across customs, but there's child sex slavery around the world.
Right. Well, including this area, from what I understand. It's everywhere. It's ubiquitous. But that's the thing I found so interesting about this collection is that the characters are thinking about real things. Like, can you replace one daughter with another? And what happens when you save someone? I got the feeling she wanted to save this girl, too, from her fate. And does that ever work? Saving somebody, do you think?
This story's bad things sometimes happen to some of the characters, but always I want the stories to enhance and enlarge people's lives. So there's always a sense in every story for me of some way in which the characters learn something new about themselves or a new way to to live in the world, I think it's almost a responsibility when you write something. In some ways, it's an aggressive act. You're asking people to listen to this story, to take their precious time for the story. So I want every story, whether it's a comic story or a serious story, to give people a sense of how life can be enhanced. And I give that to my characters often, too. They may begin in hell, but I don't leave them there.
Right. That's true. Yeah, that's what, yeah, your story is always, my feeling is anyway, that they start out with a punch right in the gut. and then I recover slowly from it. So, and another question that I thought was really interesting was, you made it when they hate you. And that's when a critic faces an artist, he savages. I thought that was fabulous. Tell us about this story and what was a germ that instigated it.
I know too well what instigated that story. I got a really horrible review. Oh, it was so painful. And so I began working with the idea of a critic who absolutely abhors a woman. Also, many years ago, I worked my way through college for a newspaper, and I interviewed a lot of actors, and I have such admiration for actors. So it's a little bit of a love song.
Because they're putting
song.
Themselves out there.
Yeah, and they have such phenomenal memories, and they give it all, and are many of them are hardly, can make a life out of what they're doing. So it's these great labors of love. So it was just a pleasure in some ways to write about it. I leave it a little ambiguous, but in some ways it may seem like an act of revenge.
I like that. But I thought it was so relevant today because not only do writers have the opportunity to have critics savage them, but anybody on Amazon or on Goodreads or any of these other public forums, I mean, it's like they rate you like they can rate detergent, you know? It's like, you know, it didn't really do the job, didn't do it for me. And sometimes I would just like to go up to these critics and say, do you know what that just did?
Yeah,
and they're anonymous, you know? So I was particularly fond of that story.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I think in some ways, you know, the book is called The Tao of Humiliation. And in many ways, because of social media and the lack of privacy, we've never been more easily humiliated in so many different corners. So there's the sense that characters have to find a pathway beyond humiliation. I think of humiliation as very social. It doesn't really happen when we're alone. We can be ashamed alone. But humiliation takes people. And so sometimes my characters, I think they're tested by situations that are humiliated, but then find a way to kind of claim their own vulnerability and learn to, accept themselves and accept others.
Who do you think was humiliated in that story, the critic or the actress?
You know, I had real compassion for both characters. I felt that the actress is a bit trapped by her brother's needs. And, of course, the critic is trapped by his hatred of his body in many ways. And so
And intimidated by her beauty.
Yes, and her longing, which he has lost in some ways. She is very good at yearning.
Uh-huh. Right. That's great. No, I think that's probably one of my favorite stories in the whole collection, and there are many of them. The next thing I want to talk to you about was there are several stories in here that are about men on a retreat, and this fascinated me. Did you feel any trepidation writing not only from one male point of view, but like five male points of view?
I enjoy writing from a male point of view in some ways. I think that I find men really fascinating. I grew up in a Catholic household and in a situation, in a school where boys were on one side of the room, girls on the other side of the room. I grew up in a situation where, in some ways, boys seemed like an exotic species, but they're not.
I think they are. and then you also write about them in one room, like talking to each other, which I thought was breathtaking because it's like usually when a woman, I mean, you either have to be a great eavesdropper or you have a great imagination, because most men, they'll change their conversation when a woman enters the situation. So how did you know all this stuff that they talk about?
I do think, though, that culturally we absorb the other gender in a way. And I have a novella called The Guide to the Flying Island, and it's written, you know, limited omniscient, but from a man's point of view. And it was so freeing. I don't think I could have written it quite the same way without, you know, I gave this man, you know, he's over 6 feet, he's a big man, but I gave him emotions that are a lot like my own in some ways. And So it was freeing. I didn't self-censor.
Well, then I think it's easier to tell the truth sometimes, too, when you put it in somebody who's very unlike you.
I agree.
So that's how you came to all those. But anyway, the story that I particularly liked in this group was What Doesn't Kill You Makes Me Stronger. I loved it. That's a great title. And tell us about this character, all these horrible untruths. I take it they're untruths.
Yes.
All these rumors come to him at some later time, and he can't seem to escape them. So tell us about that story.
Well, I think rumor has an incredible strength, and it rumor grows and it spreads. And, you know, there are probably rumors about all of us. And going back to your point about social media, there are lots of falsities that appear about all of us, probably, or misinformation spreads. And it sticks, I think. And reputation, you know, once reputation is sullied, it's hard to get it back. So I had a lot of fun with that story in so many ways.
You kept upping the ante. You know?
And once he thinks he's escaped, there comes the rumors yet again.
He hasn't. Yeah. But then you do have that moment of grace at the end where I think he decides that, well, his girlfriend loved, she must have known this stuff too, and yet she still loved him. I thought that was like one of the most beautiful endings to a story that was horrible. The torture you put your character through.
Yes. Thank you so much.
So do you think that it's impossible? Now, I guess you just said that. I guess in the age of the internet, it's almost impossible to outrun your past. You can, even if you physically leave an area, it still dogs you, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You think that? Okay. One of the things that I noticed was all of these stories seem to take place like in a dream country. There are no landmarks anywhere, and to give the location away. And so after a story or two, I accepted that I was in a landscape of the mind, but then all of a sudden you would intrude with something very particular. Like, I think it was in the first story about the biographer writing about the author. All of a sudden you say, she's going to find a hotel, the Best Western. Like, where did this come from? what country are we in here?
Yes.
And in another story, you... I think it was the one we just were talking about, Whatever Doesn't Kill You Makes Me Stronger, is everything's in that same dream landscape, and then all of a sudden one of the characters picks up a bottle of Deer Park water. And I'm there, as a poet, I know that you're very sensitive to language, so why did you pick those moments to intrude with?
I think it helps with verisimilitude that, you know, we're embodied people, we're in a place. So I want very much there to be a kind of landmark. So the stories are mapped in my mind in places I'm familiar with in some ways. But so often in life we don't recount exactly where we are.
So I think we have to take a break here right now. This is Lehigh Valley Art Salon. I'm Bathsheba Monk.
WDIY is proud to sponsor the Muhlenberg Summer Music Theater's 34th season, featuring A Chorus Line, the longest-running Broadway smash, featuring such hit songs as One and What I Did for Love, through the 29th in the Empty Theater, Trexler Pavilion for Theater and Dance. For more information, 484-664-3333 or online at muhlenberg.edu/smt.
For program support on WDIY, we thank Touchstone Theater on Bethlehem's Southside, presenting Fresh Voices, solo and ensemble-based works in progress created by Touchstone's 2013-2014 apprentices with the guidance of the Touchstone family, June 20th to June 21st at 8 p.m. For tickets or information, 610-867-1689 or touchstone.org.
This is Lehigh Valley Art Salon. I'm Bathsheba Monk. We're talking this evening to Lee Upton, whose new book of short stories, The Tao of Humiliation, is getting rave reviews. One of the things, my favorite stories is actually the first story, is the idea. I have so many favorite stories in this collection. Have
so
you noticed
glad.
That yet? And I think everybody should read this book, by the way. It's like it's one of these perfect books to read, like, before you're going to sleep at night. You read one, you think about it, and you put it aside, then you go to sleep. It's just, it's perfect. So anyway, the first story is The Ideal Reader, is about a biographer of a writer trying to find out why the subject of her study stopped writing. So tell us about this story.
That story was one that took me a long time to write, which is, I guess, ironic because it's about someone who stops writing. So I didn't stop on it, but I had a lot of stops and starts, I suppose. So I didn't have full stops, more like pauses. But I'm, I've written a good deal of literary criticism, and I'm interested in how when one is writing about a literary figure, you can in some ways almost become absorbed by that figure. I have friends who've, worked on biographies, and they take an enormous amount of time, and there's, you can forget what you did, but you can remember what your subject did, sometimes so much better. So there's a way in which a passionate biographer has to be careful, or his or her life can be supplanted by the subject. So the first critical book I did was on a poet named Jean Garrigue, and I'd go to the Berg Collection at the New York Public Library and work with others and see just the dedication of biographers. I didn't write a biography about her. I wrote a critical study, but there was so much material there. She was someone who practically wrote, it seemed like, a letter a day.
Oh, really?
And she was so prolific. And so the idea of working with another sensibility was interesting to me, to think about how literary critics do this kind of work, particularly biographers. I don't think that I would have the stamina of the biographer, these people I admire very much. I also had such fun in some ways working with something historical, that Cornell Kappa photograph, which actually exists, of George Plimpton's living room. And there are various literary luminaries there, Truman Capote, and
and that was the start of
that was the start. Uh-huh. And there are a number of men in suits, and some of their backs partly turned, and there are beautiful prints on the walls. And so it was interesting to sort of think, well, who could one of these men be? Perhaps this is this invented character of mine.
I kept thinking, aren't you worried as a writer that maybe someday somebody's going to do that to you? They're going to pick through your writings.
Oh, dear. At Lafayette, our wonderful archivist, Diane Shaw, has my papers, but my papers are my drafts rather than anything personal. And I think people would drop dead of boredom with my personal life.
But I don't think they do. See, they'll always find something to. Well, you said, talking about your personal life, I think I read an interview that you gave with somebody, I forget who now, but you started becoming interested in language because your father was losing his hearing.
Yes.
When you were growing up. Is that so? How did that manifest itself? What did you try to just speak more clearly and more precisely?
Yes, he became hard of hearing, and I was very fortunate. He, he really cared to hear what I had to say. But I remember particularly when I was a teenager, sometimes being impatient, but he loved laughter. So I would always try to find the right words for him. So I think that having that influence of someone who wanted to hear me, it was very important. I think all writers need someone somewhere who would like to hear their voice.
And So the Tao of communication, I'm thinking about communicate, the Tao of humiliation, is your second work of fiction. Is that right? Your second big work of fiction.
Yes, the second larger.
So how did you decide that these, that the things you wanted to say, and most of your books were poetry books, which you're renowned for. How did you decide that these weren't poems, that these these were stories that you had to tell.
Well, it's I think about poetry as being more like a vertical dive, and fiction, it feels more horizontal to me. I'm not sure if it feels that way to you too, but it's as if one is traveling over space in time. It was difficult to learn how to make those sorts of movements in many ways. I began the transition from poetry to fiction largely by working with voice stories, so trying to capture a particular voice. Then when I got to plotting, it involved cause and effect, and that is very difficult in order to make work that isn't simply episodic, but that each of the scenes build, and that has taken me a long time to learn how to do that.
How to think differently. It's like a different side of your brain or a different part of your brain. Well, there's one section of the story, La Belle Dame Sans Professeur. Am I saying that right?
Yes.
I would love. This is a very. It's a great scene. If you could tell us about this story and then read part of it to us.
Oh, sure. This story features a young woman who is, sadly enough, enthralled with her professor. He teaches literature, as she says, of course.
Right. That's what we all say, right? Yeah,
of course. And she makes the terrible mistake of becoming involved with him. This is a portion from a little ways into the story. She also worked, this is not an autobiographical story in any way, but the part I'm going to read for you is actually autobiographical, the one paragraph, because I did work for the city newspaper, the Lansing State Journal, and I did do this interview, and this did happen. So I'll read this portion. A week later, I was on assignment for the entertainment section of the college newspaper and walked in on Joe Cocker in the Plymouth Stadium dressing room. One of the band members was wearing tight blue briefs. It was embarrassing, but after the band members stopped shouting, they nodded at me in a good-natured, almost courtly way, and then Joe Cocker came out from somewhere and shook my hand. I took out my pad and pen and asked him questions. Who was your greatest influence? What are your future plans? And was amazed at how much he looked like my professor, as if he never slept through the night once in his entire life. His eyes were red as if from a permanent case of conjunctivitis. I told my professor about his resemblance to Joe Cocker, and he said, "You can't be right. You will never meet anyone like me." In class, my professor turned out the lights and narrated a slideshow. Aldous Huxley, Virginia Woolf, D.H. Lawrence, Hilda Doolittle, Virginia Woolf again, looking like a beautiful ferret and wearing around her neck what appeared to be an actual ferret. At one point, I wasn't watching the slides but resting my head on my desk. Suddenly, the class gasped like one mammoth lung sucking in air. I lifted my head. On the screen was a slide of my professor staring at the camera, wearing absolutely nothing, in front of a cottage said to have been inhabited by Catherine Mansfield.
Thank you. That's good.
Yeah, actually, this is, it says here,
Joe Cocker.
The narrator worked for the college paper. I actually worked for, another
paper. That's very exciting. Okay, you've just got 10 points in mind.
Maybe
my influence
all
book. So do you think there's a novel brewing inside of you now?
I do have a novel manuscript, but I'm still reworking it.
Oh, wonderful. Okay.
Thank you.
So I can hardly wait to read that. So do you have any readings or appearances coming up, or are you going to wait for the fall?
Probably more for the fall. I was just at the Moravian Writers Conference.
Oh, that's right,
Yes, just this past weekend.
That was a big success, I heard.
It was terrific. Joyce Hinnefeld did a beautiful job. I'm so lucky. She's a terrific writer.
That's great. Yeah, no, we have a lot of great writers in the Valley. We're very lucky. So where can people buy your book, The Tao of Humiliation, and where can they find out more about you?
Amazon.com has it. Barnes & Noble has it. The publisher, Wonderful Boa Editions, has it as well too, but it's pretty much on any, there are quite a few websites that have it available, and just Google Lee Upton. I have some doppelgangers, but
okay, great. Well, we're so happy. Thank you so much for being on the show tonight, Lee. We were talking to Lee Upton, who is the author of the book of short stories, The Tao of Humiliation. This is Lehigh Valley Art Salon. I'm Bathsheba Monk.